Victoza and eventually Ozempic. So what they found in the confirmatory trial was not only did it control blood sugar, but it also helped the patients lose weight.
Really? This is like a burning question I've had for years and I just have never looked it up. And now I have you, a human WebMD.
It actually changed the shape of my face. I have pictures of it.
Really? I don't know if I could eat like a tomahawk steak raw like that, you know? And I'd be like, it feels fine. And then you'd go like, and I'd be like, ow, what the hell? And then I'd be like focused on that. And he'd be like, well, how's your knuckle feel? And I'd be like, I don't know. Welcome to Days at Night. We're having Chubby Emu on. Do you want to be referred to as Chubby Emu or do you want to be referred to as your actual name?
Yeah, Bernard, Dr. Bernard, Chubby
Dr.
Emu,
Bernard.
Whichever one's good.
I'm down with Dr. Bernard. I mean, you earned the PhD.
Thank you.
You know, call you by your official title. Would you tell the audience about like what you do a little bit? I'm sure a lot of your fans are here, but
yeah,
you know,
definitely.
Just in case they don't know.
So when I talk, which camera do I look at?
You can look at any of the three, right? So he can look at this.
Okay.
That's probably most natural for you.
Okay, cool. This one. Okay, perfect. Okay. All right. So I'm Dr. Bernard. You might know me as Chubby Emu on YouTube. I've been on for 9 years now, since 2015. And I'm a toxicologist by training. I did a residency and a fellowship. And you know me from the videos that I post online talking about cases that either I've seen in the past or my colleagues that I work with on the videos have seen in the past, or sometimes they're published in literature.
Very nice. That's a solid intro. Okay, so one thing that we talked about before you came on was your involvement in Ozempic really early on, before it was known as Ozempic even. Can you speak to that experience a little bit?
Yeah, so it was interesting. The precursor, if you will, to Ozempic was another medicine called Victoza, also known as liraglutide. So that's the
where do the names come from?
So the lira part, I'm not sure, but glutide is part of the way that the medicine works.
Oh.
So it's a GLP-1 agonist, so glucagon-like peptide. So that's where the glue part comes from. Yeah. And so like you'll see all the competitors of Ozempic, they'll all have the glutide part. And the tide part means that it's a protein. So it's a peptide.
That
so it's a
sense.
Chain of multiple proteins. And so what's interesting is in probably the last 20 years, we've lived through multiple huge revolutions in diabetes treatments. So there's in context of diabetes, right? So it's a problem of sugar in the body. There's two main types. So you have type 1 diabetes, where the pancreas can't make insulin anymore. So what typically happens is when you eat, you get all the nutrients everywhere in your body, and your body needs a way to say, hey, cells, we have nutrients. You need to take them in. So the way that it signals that is through hormones.
Got it.
And insulin is that hormone that comes from the pancreas to say, hey, there's a bunch of sugar in the blood now because this person just ate, so let's absorb it.
Right.
Now, the problem is in type 1 diabetes, the pancreas just doesn't make insulin. In type 2 diabetes, the pancreas makes it, but the cells don't do anything with it.
Right, so it just sits there in your blood?
Yeah, and so in both cases, you could either get too high of blood sugar or just it can go down real quick. So it's always a problem of blood sugar control. And so that's when they discovered insulin back in the early 1900s.
Because of diabetic shock, like they were trying to work backwards or?
So it was mostly because of type 1 diabetes where these people, they wouldn't live for very long because they couldn't really eat because their body wasn't releasing the insulin. So the sugar wasn't going down. And so they didn't eat very much. They were malnourished. And finally, when they discovered that this hormone actually exists to lower the blood sugar, what they did was the original insulin from the early 1900s was from cows and from pigs.
Really?
And so they would ground up either cow or pig pancreas and extract the insulin and then injected into these type 1 diabetics, and it was a game changer.
Wow.
Life-saving. Now, the problem with that is pork and beef insulin, they differ just by a little bit.
Right.
On the insulin protein. And so in humans, over time, what happens is you become allergic.
Oh, it starts to reject it?
Yes.
Similar to like concerns with bovine valves and stuff, right?
Right.
Got it.
And so patients in like the 50s and 60s used to swap. They're like, oh, well, I'm getting allergic reactions now to beef insulin. I'm going to move over to pork.
Switch it up.
And then switch it over again.
Wow.
And so what's interesting is in 1980, there was a company that figured out, well, we know what the chain of human insulin is. Can we genetically engineer it, inject that gene into a bacteria, and force the bacteria to make that exact protein?
So is that like early DNA hacking, or is it like different?
Yeah.
That's cool. Okay, so I was right.
So it was the birth of biotech.
Wow.
Yeah. And so it was a company called Genentech that was the first one that did it in 1980. And once they figured out, oh, we can get bacteria to make human insulin, we didn't have to deal with pork or beef anymore.
Wow. Get them out of here. We don't even need them anymore.
Yeah.
Okay.
And so that was two revolutions of diabetes treatments.
Yeah.
And so what happened was throughout the 80s, they figured out, you know what? We know this protein sequence, or the amino acids and everything. Is there a way where we could slow down how quickly that insulin gets absorbed in the body? And is there another way where we can make it really quick? And why that would be a benefit to patients is in the hospital. Let's just say somebody has type 2 diabetes and they have trouble controlling their blood sugar. They ate dinner and now their blood sugar is sky high and you want to control it. Well, we can give a slow acting insulin for the nighttime. And hopefully it's so slow that when they wake up to use the bathroom, that they won't fall down because the blood sugar is too low.
Right.
So it is a very slow acting insulin. And then there's one that's very fast acting, because let's just say somebody's having a blood sugar emergency. So they need a real fast acting. Yeah. We need to lower it right now.
Save their life.
Yeah.
Situation.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so they came up with both of those use cases. And that happened in probably around 2000.
God, that's so cool. Yeah.
And so regular human insulin is, in some states you can get it over the counter, or you'd have to ask for it, but you can get it for relatively low price. It's usually like when we argue about the insulin prices, a lot of times, not all the time, but it's the fast and the slow acting ones.
That makes sense. We have Eli Lilly in Indianapolis, like the huge campus. So we hear people talk about insulin all the time.
Yeah.
That's interesting. And then Ozempic is obviously, is it a for slow or fast, or is it both, or
so,
its own thing?
So it's its own thing.
Okay.
And so what happened was by 2009, 2010, the company that had the patent on the fast acting insulin, I think it had already expired.
Right, because they last like about 25 years, standard patents.
Yeah. And so they thought, well, we specialize in diabetes. Is there something additional that we could do? So in 2010, they got Victoza, liraglutide, approved. Mm. And it controlled blood sugar in a little bit different of a way. What happened maybe about 5 years earlier, there was another kind of diabetes medicine that you take as a tablet. And it helps control blood sugar.
I remember seeing commercials for that.
Yeah.
So you don't have to use the needle. Like for people that are scared of the needle, they can just... Yeah,
they're called the Gliptins. So
Gliptin.
That's the generic name for them. So the first one was Sitagliptin.
I think
it came out in 2006.
I mean, I love the names for all of these. They all have good names.
And it was Januvia is the brand name for it.
Januvia.
And so what was interesting is that it stops the breakdown of certain hormones that get the pancreas to release insulin.
Got it.
Now, how that's related to Victoza and eventually Ozempic is that it stops the breakdown of what Victoza is. And so we already now have two parts of this pathway that leads to blood sugar control. So in 2010, when they got liraglutide approved, they found out in the confirmatory clinical trial. So the way that the drugs get approved in the United States is you have to do the study.
Yeah.
And then when you do the study, you have to prove that it does something and that it's safe. Those are the two big ones. And so they found out, yes, liraglutide does something and it's relatively safe. There was a warning that was slapped on it right at the get-go.
Right. You know, about, there can be some caveats, like may cause heart attack in some patients. And, you know, they always have like lists at the end of infomercials. So like there's a certain amount of risk allowed as long as it does a certain amount of good.
Yeah. And the FDA requires that you have to say those in the direct-to-consumer ads, which you know.
That's why they always say it's super fast.
Yeah.
May cause heart attack and stroke.
Yeah. It always gets kind of like an awkward situation.
Yeah.
So what they found in the confirmatory trial was not only did it control blood sugar, mm-hmm. but it also helped the patients lose weight.
Right.
And so they noticed that, wait a second, like how is it doing this? And what's interesting is the liraglutide came from a discovery in the saliva of the Gila monster.
Really?
Yes.
Tell me about that.
So it's a natural product, and I don't exactly know how they came across it,
mm-hmm.
but it was there's a branch of medicine called pharmacognosy,
okay.
where they try to find medicines from natural products. So either extracts from animals right. or extracts from plants or bacteria and all of that. So they found that this saliva of this Gila monster, mm-hmm. if you change the protein just a little bit, it kind of mimics a digestive hormone that we have in our body. So why don't we try and change it a little bit and then inject it in. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Okay, that's pretty cool.
Yeah, and so around that time, the company was having some, because their patent just expired,
mm-hmm.
so they needed a new compound to try to save the company, if you will. And so this was the one that kind of saved them. It became a $1 billion drug, I think, within like a year or two.
Unsurprising, because I mean, with diabetes, wouldn't it be mutually beneficial to be able to control your weight as well? Like, you don't want to be too skinny. You don't want to be too overweight. You want to stay within a healthy range.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah. And so what's interesting is fast forward a couple years, we're like 2014, 2015.
Mm-hmm.
The landscape now, and Eli Lilly was part of this, was that you can change some of the proteins mm-hmm. on this liraglutide mm-hmm. compound. And what happens then is that you only need to do it once a week, not once every day.
Oh, wow. That actually is huge. That's a huge difference.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so that was where they thought, well, wait a second. If you're only doing it once a week, you're more likely to stick to it rather than you got to do it every day. Then some people say, I don't want to stick a needle in me today. Yeah. You know, I'm done with it.
It's overwhelming.
Right.
Yeah.
And so they found out, it's the same principle as the insulin. We can change some of the proteins, make it a little bit slower. And then from there, or we could make it faster if we really wanted to.
Mm-hmm.
And then they used that same principle. And then again, they found out, actually there's weight loss involved in here. So around that time, they were really trying to push all of that.
Mm-hmm.
And they wanted to be like, is there a way that we can have a weight loss compound that isn't psychoactive, directly psychoactive in how we normally treat obesity at this particular point? So that was where the beginnings of it was. The compound semaglutide is a little bit different than liraglutide. It's different by like a couple proteins.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe it can act slower. So you don't need to give it every day.
Right. Yeah. Okay. And so the way that, from a dietary standpoint, the way that it functions from what I understand is it's an appetite suppressant, right? But it also just does it make your metabolism go up, or how does it make people lose weight so quickly?
So it is a hormone for the stomach.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that it does is that it does slow down how quickly stuff moves through the stomach.
Got it.
That's one. The other one is that it also then helps control blood sugar. And so by doing those two things at a minimum, there's probably a lot more going mm-hmm. on there, but just doing those two things will help with blood sugar control and with weight.
Right. So if it's going slowly through your digestive system, you're going to feel full longer as well. So you're not going to deal with like the hunger pains and all the negative aspects of dieting. So do you think that's why it's boomed so much in the celebrity space?
So yeah, I think in the celebrity space, because the thing is, you know, a lot of times people will say, big pharma wants to make as much money off mm-hmm. of, you know, the people not, people just can't do the lifestyle adjustment or whatever.
Yeah.
That's not, I'm not, you know, shilling for big pharma in this case, because I don't work for that company anymore, right? But what's interesting is that it's the diet and exercise are the mainstay.
Yeah.
The issue is that what we call adherence. So it's like, well, you could diet for 3 months and then rebound again and then, you know, live your life before that 3 months again and then get back to where you were.
Originally were, right.
And so that's where then it has a good efficacy. So it mm-hmm. does a lot if you can pull it off. But whether or not you stick with it is an issue.
It's up to you, right? So if your lifestyle doesn't change overall, no amount of exercising and dieting is going to help you if you stop doing that.
Right. And sometimes people in the clinic will get I don't want to say jaded, but they just know from experience that some people would just not stick with it. Even you recommend diet and exercise, they might just say, I won't stick with it.
Yeah, or so, if they're a compulsive eater or something like that, there's other things going on that they feel like they're just probably not predisposed to be able to make these shifts so easily.
And in some cases, the medicines will cause temporary diabetes.
Oh.
Yeah, so some people might be taking like steroids for their immune system. So we call them glucocorticoids, not the anabolic steroids.
Right.
You know,
we will get into those later, though. Yes.
And so those steroids, they will cause blood sugar to jump up.
Got it.
And it actually, some of them are very difficult medicines to take. Mm-hmm. So then, you know, we can add on some of the diabetes medicines mm-hmm. in certain cases. But it becomes a balance, right? So a lot of times people will say, oh, well, the moment I go off of Wegovy or Ozempic, I just gain all the weight back.
Yeah, I've seen a lot of people on TikTok saying that. Yeah. And then the comments, like, you know, they're a mixed bag of people saying that, oh, it's because of the way you're living your life, and other people being like, no, the same thing happened to me. So you think it is more of lifestyle?
It depends, right? So it's not always lifestyle, because that particular person's situation might be different. They might be taking, you know, certain medicines that are causing it. Certain like antidepressants mm-hmm. will also cause
weight gain.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And they'll cause, you know, metabolic changes in the body. Mm-hmm. And then also just changes with how people will respond to things like food and drink. Mm-hmm. So all of that needs to be accounted for. And a lot of times the granularity gets lost in the
comments. Just a lot of variables. And there's also the genetic factor, which a lot of people, when it comes to like the fitness space.
Yes.
It's sort of like almost like controversial, the role that genetics play in things, because half the times I see comment sections that are like, I'm so glad that this creator is admitting that a lot of their success is due to genetic factors. Then other people get demoralized by that, where they're like, well, can we have some routines that just work for everybody no matter what?
Right.
You know, and it's like, what is there a workaround for that, do you think? Or
I mean, the thing is, like, it really does need to be tailored to the person and their situation. There's so many different factors going on, and like when you've seen enough patients and you've talked with enough people, mm-hmm. like no two people are the same.
Yeah.
And so to be able to tailor it to them in a way that's palatable. I remember when I was in school, we had a lecture about diabetes.
Yeah.
And around that time I was, you know, doing my powerlifting thing.
Yeah, you're getting jacked.
Yeah. And the lecturer said this one thing that I remember shaking my head at, but then I thought about it. I was like, I'm going to not think this way later in my life. I'm almost sure.
You were like, it's going to come back around. I'm going to reassess.
And she said, like, when I work with patients, this is her words, like she's paraphrasing. Mm-hmm. She said, some patients have trouble being active. And it could even just be as simple as, if they don't have weights at home, have them hold soup cans in their hands and try to do like a shoulder press kind of movement just to get them moving.
Yeah.
It doesn't need to be, you know, hardcore bodybuilding, you know, athletes.
Super strict, like regimented, classic workout
schedule. It's just a thing of getting them moving. Mm-hmm. And so I remember that very clearly. And then when I started going into practice, I remember I was like, oh, this is a reality.
Yeah.
Right. And I even see it with my own family. Like my dad has type 2 diabetes mm-hmm. and just getting him moving around, it doesn't need to be, you know, running 5 miles every day in the morning. It's just getting him walking around, getting him moving, and he's doing really well. Yeah.
Just getting him on that. I feel like that's me. Like I struggle in a gym environment, but like I need because I have chronic pain because my whole spine is fused. So I have like a hard time moving around sometimes. I would rather lie down. Because I just don't feel comfortable when I'm moving. But the more I move, the better I feel moving is the thing. So I got to move around.
Yes.
I don't always like doing it. My boyfriend's got to make me do it and I don't like doing it. But then I feel much better at the end of the day, you know? So sometimes it is just a matter of like getting up, cooking food, walking around, doing stuff instead of just like waking up, getting your coffee, sitting in a chair.
Right.
You know, which I feel like a lot of people fall into that trap, especially as they get older.
Yeah, and contextually, it's hard to switch because it's like I'm sitting at the computer and it's like, do I really want to get up? No. I just want to, let me just focus on this, what I'm doing. And then like hours later, you still haven't gotten up. And
you're like, well, now the day is almost, it's 5 o'clock. I might as well just lie down. Yeah. That's me. And then I have to be like, don't get up, go outside. Having pets makes it easier because I have to take them outside. Ah, okay. So then I'm like, I'm forced to go.
Yes.
Unless I want to like clean up dog pee in my carpet, which I don't. So then I'm like, I got to get out of there. But with Ozempic, I've been seeing a lot of people on TikTok, and I'm so interested to hear what you think about this. Because, like, I have, like, a suspicion, but I'm not, like, an expert. I've been seeing a lot of women specifically talking about how they've struggled with fertility over the last few years. And then within months of taking Ozempic, they've accidentally gotten pregnant. Do you think that that's correlation? Do you think it's causation?
So it's interesting. There could be an underlying mechanism that if their blood sugar is starting to become more controlled, that that could then produce an environment or a state of their body which would be more conducive to, you know, getting pregnant.
Yeah, that makes sense. That's what I was kind of leaning towards, because everyone has been saying that it's probably just correlation. But when I was recovering from spinal surgery, I went through like a 2-year period where like I had no fertility at all, which like they told me to expect. Just because your body's in like such a state of shock that it's like, once you get sawed in half, your body is not going to put a baby in you. Because like, obviously you can't support that until your spine stabilizes.
Yes.
And so then like, now I'm back to normal fertility wise, but there's definitely like certain things that can cause your body to be inhospitable for a while. And it might not be forever, you know?
Yeah. Physiologic stress, which I'm guessing.
Yeah. That's what,
told you. Yeah. It has a very big impact on the state of one's body. And so, but that's a proposed mechanism. Whether or not that's what's actually happening, it would depend, right? So I would just say those are personal anecdotes right now.
Yeah.
And it's not to take away from their experience. Inside these pharma companies, there's departments
that are focusing on these kinds of things.
Yes.
Right?
It's called pharmacovigilance.
So they're looking for patterns of things that could potentially be useful for things like Ozempic. And I'm sure in the trials, you guys track that kind of stuff as well.
They're required by the FDA to do something called a phase 4 study. So what gets the approval is a phase 3 study. So phase 4 is after it's been approved on the market.
More audience, like greater use.
Lots more people. Mm-hmm. And you, with more people, you'll be able to pick out more of
patterns.
Potentially what's going on.
Okay. Yeah. Cause I saw some people speculating like, I don't know how true this is, first of all. This might be misinformation, so maybe you can clear this up, because I don't want to put medical misinformation out in the world. But I saw some people talking about how when you're overweight, it can make it more difficult to get pregnant. And I saw a lot of people pushing back on that. So I am neutral in that stance. I don't know what is true as far as that goes.
I think it depends on the degree of overweight.
Okay.
Because the... women do have a higher body fat percentage compared to men on average. And if one has too low of body fat percentage, that's also a detriment.
Right. That is also a detriment. I know you definitely can't get pregnant if a lot of women who struggle with EDs also have fertility issues because of that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so people who have chronically high blood sugar that's uncontrolled, that could have an impact on whether or not they're the chances of getting pregnant. Not to say it won't happen, but it might be harder to do it.
Might be a limiting factor, yeah.
Yes.
So then as they're losing weight, that could also be a thing that's potentially affecting their fertility.
Yeah.
Okay, that's interesting. That makes a lot of sense. On to steroids.
Oh,
because
we
briefly touched on those. And this is like a burning question I've had for years, and I just have never looked it up. And now I have you, a human WebMD, so that I can ask, why do steroids make you so old in the face?
That's an interesting question. I don't think we know.
And really?
So we have some hypotheses, but there's a lot of things like when you hear about aging research, it's hard to quantify like how old somebody is. Like you might see online people would say like, oh, my, you know, biologic age is 36 and I'm actually 58 or something as an example. How do we quantify that?
I know. I'm always skeptical of that, because I'm like, you might look like 26 to me, but what if on the inside you're just like rotting?
Right.
And like you just look great, you know?
But like, did you like take their cells and then like start counting like the chromatin and like all the stuff?
26-year-old cell, like, but he says he's 48.
Right.
Yeah. That makes sense to me.
quantifying it was like, how would you do that? The other thing too is in the clinic, I mean, we don't have those measures. Like there isn't a good way.
There's no metric for that, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like there's no way to calculate it. Like there's no way that we could tell a patient. Sometimes like you'll hear your doctor say like, you know, maybe to your dad or something, to be like, you have the heart of a 50-year-old and you're 80 years old or something.
Yeah, but they don't mean it in like a literal sense. They're just like, your heart health is great, you know?
Yeah.
Like it's just like a way of saying like, you look great, you know?
And so when it comes to steroids, I think there's a couple things, right? So the skin responds to hormones. Mm-hmm. And so it's possible that the androgens, like the testosterone and all that, when you increase that in the body, mm-hmm. it then changes the balance inside your body. Mm-hmm. And it could do something to the skin based on the fact that skin responds to those hormones.
Got it. It looks thicker. I don't know if it actually is like thickening, but it always looks like thick.
Yeah.
Is it thicker?
I've heard people say it might be thinner in some cases.
Oh, really?
of like gross abuse.
Interesting.
Of steroids. The other hypothesis that I have mm-hmm. is that it's what I noticed when I was doing powerlifting and all of that stuff when I was in college, is that the more protein I eat, mm-hmm. it actually changed the shape of my face. I have pictures of it.
Really? How did it change? Did it make it more square? What happened?
So it actually like, so right now my cheeks are kind of like, it almost looks like in some cases,
mewing.
Like, yeah, right. The buckle fat. it inverts when I eat too much protein.
It gets.
And like, it just. Yeah.
Bigger in the jowl area?
Yeah. Like it'll start to be shaped like a pear.
That's so interesting because like I know like dermatology wise, because like I get acne scar treatments, this area is so hard to get thicker. Maybe right. I should start eating more protein.
Maybe
that's what I need to do. I'm gonna try. I'll text you in a couple months.
Okay.
Like, do I look pear shaped? Have you seen a change? So like, okay, so we don't have an actual answer on it. I just know that like We've got to eventually find one, because I feel like all of like the fitness bros who like are like bright red, so like you can tell mm-hmm. that there's some sort of like a cyst happening.
Yes.
I guess is like the nicest way to put it, like some performance enhancer. They always, they look so much aggressively older than when they start the fitness journey and they're not red yet. So it makes me think that like previously they probably weren't using any sort of steroids, or I don't even know if like, does pre-workout have steroids in it?
No, supplements typically won't. But what's interesting is the protein aspect. It really does go along with the steroid use, because you know if you're using gear, right, you'll wanna eat more, right? And so that part, there are some people who say like they know why protein ages you. But I don't know. I don't know if
you're
there's
not
a
sure
good,
how legit it is.
There's some people that might report a couple studies, but like in terms of like medical treatment of mm-hmm. patients, like that's not something.
Yeah, it hasn't been peer reviewed enough to like get any solid answer.
Yeah,
that makes a lot of sense. With like pre workout and stuff, I've never. Actually, that's not true. I almost lied on the pod. I took pre-workout one time.
Oh, okay.
I like mixed it in with my coffee and it made it all chunky. And ooh. Then I was grossed out. And so I didn't drink it after that. But I know some people like swear by it. But I've also seen other people be like, it's meth. So like what's up with pre-workout? Is it like a spectrum? Does it depend on the brand? Is it good? Is it bad? What do you think?
Pre-workout, or at least from what I remember, like when I was in college, was that it was just... It was kind of just becoming a thing. There was a precursor to it, I remember, from like 2007 mm-hmm. of something called peri-workout supplement.
Peri-workout.
So there was a thing that we used to do, and it never, like, I hated it. It was called Waxy Maize.
Waxy Maize?
Yeah. And
you ate it?
I don't think people do it anymore. And so it was cornstarch.
Ew.
Yeah, and it was what they call high molecular weight carbohydrates.
Okay.
So the rationale for it was like you put this cornstarch in water, and then like as you're warming up on your squats, like you drink this cornstarch. It would always settle to the bottom.
Yeah, and it gets gross at the bottom.
Yeah,
that's what happened to my coffee.
Yeah, it's really disgusting. It was almost like a clay.
Ew, like a paste. I saw like a girl would take her pre-workout and get it like damp and mold it into like balls and eat it.
Oh.
And I was disturbed by that. Like, I don't know. And people were like, that's so bad for you. And I was like, I don't know if it's worse for you than like drinking it, but it does look terrible to me. Like, I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, it gets in your body the same
that's
way.
That's what I'm thinking, right? Like,
it's
you're
the same dose.
Gonna just digest. It's like when people are like mix their food together and they're like, it's all going to the same place.
Yeah.
Versus people who separate it and stuff. I feel like sphere or no, it's probably equally good or bad
yeah.
for you or neutral.
As long as it's not like triple the dose.
Yeah. Well, because you talked about that TikToker that took like eight
scoops.
A pre-workout, and like, what's the standard? Like one, two?
Yeah, usually one. Or yeah. You want to stay away from taking too much of it because there's a lot of stimulants in there.
Yeah, because it hypes you up. Like, it's got caffeine and stuff, right?
Yeah, people will start shaking like during their set because they're so amped
they're
up.
They're amped.
Yeah,
they're ready to go.
But back to Waxy Maze.
Oh yeah, back to Waxy. We'll get to our TikToker.
Yes,
Waxy Maze. Tell me about this disturbing.
So you would drink it while you're warming up.
Mm-hmm.
And you drink it, and the rationale is that it goes through your stomach real quick and then absorbs into your intestines. And you'll get carbohydrates floating around in your blood that will then supply your muscles with the carbs that you need.
That sounds like a recipe for like power lifters to like shit themselves, honestly. Like, that's all I can think about.
It didn't last for very long. I remember like there was a whole bunch of hype behind it, and then people were like, this doesn't do anything.
It didn't do anything?
Yeah.
It was just like a placebo?
Yeah. It wasn't, I didn't like it, but that was, to me, that was like a precursor to pre-workout. I think obviously the idea of it was from a long time ago.
Yeah.
And even this peri-workout. So while you're working out, you're drinking this starch mix and then you have your shake afterwards and then you have your big meal and all of that.
Within your 30-minute window so that everything works.
So the 30-minute window is kind of a newer thing.
Is it?
Yeah.
My boyfriend swears by the 30-minute food window.
I think,
is it accurate?
I think there's some truth to it.
Okay. Because the NFL rides for that 30-minute window.
Yeah.
Like, they're serious about it.
Yeah. I think it's a newer innovation, but it definitely has merit, I think. Now, whether or not it actually works, it doesn't hurt to just make sure that you eat well after you're done training.
That makes sense. Right? For people who don't know, the 30-minute window is like after you work out, you're supposed to eat like a good balanced meal within 30 minutes to make your workout like count as much as possible.
Yeah.
Okay, cool. So now I have to keep doing it because he's listening. He's in the background over there like, see, I told you. You got to, because I always forget. Like, I always want to just like, go to sleep after exercise. And he's like, you got to eat.
Yeah, you got to eat. And that was one of the first things that I remember when I started doing the powerlifting mm-hmm. thing was for like 2 years, I wasn't making any progress.
Because you weren't eating enough? Yeah.
Wasn't eating enough afterwards and I wasn't eating enough throughout the day. Yeah. I remember I went to the powerlifting gym in Illinois and one of the coaches was like, well, first of all, like you need to be 275 pounds if you want to lift any weight.
Yeah.
And I was like...
And you're like, oh... I didn't know that.
Yeah. Yeah. And they were like, yeah, because your distance of moving is more than a guy that's, a little bit smaller in terms of weight and size. And so they were just like, yeah, you have to, your range of motion is too much. So you got to beef it
up. Yeah.
And then that way, then the cross section of the area that the weight's sitting on is greater.
Makes it a little more balanced. Got to do one of these, you know?
But I couldn't bring myself to get to 275 pounds. It was hard.
Yeah. I feel for the guys, like the O-line guys who are like huge. They have to eat so much every day. And like some of those guys, like I know they're like nauseous. They're just like choking it down.
Yeah.
And I don't think I have the willpower. I have like a great respect for it because I'm like, I don't know if I could make myself eat that much.
Yeah.
You know?
I think in the context of sports and athletics, mm-hmm. it's harder to gain weight than it is to lose weight.
Yeah, definitely. Because like you're moving so much that like the weight's probably just gonna fall off, you know? But those guys who have to like constantly like bulk up, like the off season, they lose a lot of weight and then when they're getting back out there, they gotta eat like eight meals a day. It's crazy actually. Like the facility like provides a lot of it, but I don't know if I could ever like beat somebody. Like if I was like an actor or something and I had to gain like a ton of weight for a role, I think I would be able to do it, but I think I would really struggle, you know?
It's unpleasant.
Yeah.
Like, I when I was doing, I gained up to, I went from 160 to 242 and I would.
It's a big difference.
Yeah.
That took me a second to process where I was like, good for you. That's hard.
It was awful doing it because I remember I had like those frozen lasagnas like family size. Mm-hmm. I would have one for dinner and then like the next morning you wake up, you have like a dozen eggs. Ugh. You have a gallon of milk before noon.
Eggs.
And you have like a loaf of bread. You felt disgusting.
Yeah.
And like you had to eat until it was like on the way up.
Yeah. And then you're like,
And you do it four more times that day. And it ended with that 2.5 pound family size lasagna.
That's
and
I was crazy. Like,
it was awful.
There's a lady on TikTok who I don't know what she does. I don't even think she does powerlifting or anything like that. But she was one of those raw meat people. Have you seen those people where they love eating steak and stuff? I like a good steak tartare, from time to time. Mm-hmm. So I get it, but I don't know if I could eat a tomahawk steak raw like that, I don't know that that's me. But she was recently I've been eating 12 boiled eggs in the morning and then raw steak. And I was you have got to just have the gnarliest movements of anyone. That's actually an insane choice.
Yeah.
She is living a cave woman. I mean, I had a weird respect for it, honestly, because I was I don't know if I could be you.
Yeah.
If I had to, I don't know if I could do it. That's so much protein.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
Yeah. And protein, the thing that I noticed when I was eating too much is, so your liver can only process so much, mm-hmm. When you're eating like that. And the special thing about protein is the amino acids. So amino means it has nitrogen in it.
Mm-hmm.
And so when your liver processes anything that has nitrogen, it breaks it down to the most simple form, which is ammonia. And so you start to sweat and it smells like ammonia.
Ammonia?
And you use the bathroom and it smells like ammonia. Yeah. And so gross excess protein.
You're going to smell crazy.
That. Yeah.
Wow. I never knew that. So when people talk about getting the meat sweats, it's a real thing?
Yeah.
It's just ammonia sweats? That's actually insane.
Well, I don't know if it's ammonia, but.
But still though, it's a nasty sweat smell from eating too much protein.
Yeah.
That actually tracks. I'm thinking back on my life and I'm like, yeah. I feel like I know people who have the ammonia sweats. Okay, our TikToker though. So
oh yeah.
What I didn't watch that video. I saw the thumbnail and I was like, I don't want it to be spoiled. I want him to tell me about it. Can you give a brief summary about that? Because I know boomers love when kids on TikTok do crazy dumb things where they're just like, they're eating Tide Pods, they're going crazy, they're dyeing their hair pink. What's going on?
Yeah.
So what the heck happens if you eat that much pre-workout?
There's two things. So it was a guy who I guess tried to get clout on TikTok by dry scooping, which had always existed, but it was really becoming a thing around that time.
Okay,
late 2020.
Dry scooping, that kind of touches on what we were talking about earlier with her eating it like a bowl or a ball. I see people talk about dry scooping all the time, which is where you just take the pre-workout and you just put it in your mouth mm-hmm. Cinnamon Challenge style. It's more potent, right? Because it's not watered down, or what does that have an extra danger to it, or is it just gross and
not really
floury?
It's a convenience measure in most cases.
Okay.
So for example, when I took creatine in my powerlifting days, you could mix it with a whole glass of water mm-hmm. and then drink the glass of water, or you could just take the spoon and then
just dump it
and then just take it like a pill.
Okay. Okay. So it doesn't do anything more messed up when it's dry.
No.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's I've always wondered about that, because I see people do the videos and everyone in the comments is like, the dry scoop. Crazy.
I got a lot of comments saying that, dry scooping's not bad. And I'm like, I didn't say it was bad, but taking 8 scoops is bad.
Yeah. Okay. So, all right. So continue with your story now that I have clarification on that.
Yes. So that was around that time that, people were showing them dry scooping and, taking whatever. So I think he did take an excess amount
mm-hmm.
of pre-workout. And the dangers of that were two main ingredients. Now, some of the others might have been a danger. We don't really know. But caffeine was the most immediate one.
That makes sense.
Yeah. And if each scoop has 200 milligrams of caffeine and you take 8, well.
It has that much in one scoop?
Maybe.
Or two scoops?
Maybe. So it depends on which product.
Right.
I think the products are different, but some of them might have 200.
I've seen some of the workout energy drinks, the little shots have about that much. And that's a lot.
There's a new can of energy drink that I found at Walmart that has 300 milligrams a can. And I was like, what?
That's insane. Why do you need that?
Yeah.
You don't.
The daily recommended limit is 400. So you're right there.
Yeah.
It'd be two cans of Monster or Rockstar or whatever. But yeah, so it was a gross amount of caffeine, which would then explain his jitteriness and, all of that, because what happens is that around 1200 milligrams of caffeine is when majority of people are going to start to exhibit toxic effects.
Oh.
So 1200 milligrams of caffeine is a lot. Yeah. It's like, I've got to be like 20 Mountain Dews or something. Like
crazy.
Is it? So a Mountain Dew can might have like 60.
Still, anything more than like 4 Mountain Dews is like insane to me.
Yeah. So it was a gross excess, and 1200 milligrams is where you'll start to really have like your heart will be skipping a beat. You'll be sweating. You'll be shaking.
Like a sense of like panic probably.
Yeah. Yeah. Like just like a shrouding sense of doom, like anxiety will start to show up. I believe that's why they say 400 milligrams as the daily limit. They take a third of that.
Yeah, that makes sense.
This particular patient took a lot of caffeine, but there was another compound in that particular pre-workout. It was called a betalphenylethylamine. And the name is important because there's another compound called alpha-methylphenylethylamine. And when you abbreviate it, it becomes amphetamine.
Yikes.
And so
that's where the meth comes from. Finally, so, closure on the meth.
Yes. And so beta phenylethylamine, which was in this particular pre-workout product, it does get broken down in the brain. Mm-hmm. But when you take a gross excess of it, what we call the toxicokinetics, so the way that it passes through your body starts to change. Because it doesn't get broken down by the regular mechanisms anymore because those mechanisms have been overwhelmed.
Yeah, they're like, you're going to OD on this. We got to just...
Right. And so what happened is this particular patient had a brain bleed.
Oh my God.
Yeah. And that was from what we call a hypertensive crisis. So it looked like the blood vessels in his brain had constricted to the point where the blood pressure was so high.
Oh man, they just burst.
Something gave way. And they had to crack open part of his skull to relieve the pressure because the brain is enclosed inside the skull.
Yeah.
It's very rigid space. And if it's expanding the brain, it can then squeeze through the cracks in the skull if you don't do anything about it.
It can squeeze through the cracks in your skull?
Yes.
Oh my goodness. Yeah.
They call that a herniation.
I've heard of a herniation. I just didn't know went through your skull cracks.
Yeah, it can ooze through the cracks, or it can fold on itself inside the brain because it's expanding. So there's like a lot of different kinds of herniations. But yeah,
that's insane. Actually, I had benign intracranial hypertension one time, and that was a truly abysmal experience. So like, I can't even imagine what like a brain bleed from something like that would feel like. That would be insane.
Yeah.
And did he live?
I think so. I don't know. The case was given to me by a colleague at the poison center. They de-identified it.
Yeah, of course.
And so it was just, it was like a three-liner saying the outcome and then what they did when they were
Treating. Yeah. Okay. So like he might've lived, but maybe not. That's just like the treatment approach.
Yeah.
Wow. Stop doing dumb stuff for clout, you know? Like, you can't. You talk a lot about taking recommended dosages and not, like, exceeding recommended dosages. And, like, this is a perfect cautionary tale of, like, why not to do that?
Right.
I think sometimes, like, we were watching your video, my brother and I, like, earlier in the week, about the man who got, like, an STD or STI of some sort, and he took was it weed killer he, like, sprayed?
Yeah,
and he thought that it was working, which, like, I'm sure it never was. But he thought it was killing the bacteria and that his skin would fall off and, like, replace the way it does for plants. And he kept spraying it. And he thought, like, even if it was effective, he thought that, like, spraying it longer and keeping it on would make it more effective. Mm-hmm. And I think people think that with a lot of stuff. Like, if you have a really bad headache, you take, like, way more ibuprofen, but really, like, don't do that with anything. You should never go over because it's not going to make it work like five times as much. It's going to start causing other problems, right?
Yeah, there was a thing that I did when I was a kid. Mm-hmm. There's a Chinese herbal medicine that you can give in headaches that it's top.
Is it Tiger Balm?
It's similar. Yeah.
I love Tiger Balm.
Yeah. It's similar. And the thing is, I found out on my own because it's camphor and menthol, so it gives you that real
minty
and I found out if you put water on top of it, it burns it even
it makes
harder.
It feel more minty.
Yes, and you focus just on the minty feel,
yeah,
and then you forget about the headache.
Yeah,
but when I did it, I started getting like burns on my forehead.
Oh, because of the combination. Oh my God.
Yeah. And so like I came to that conclusion on my own. And yeah. So it's like
you field tested yourself, you know. Yes. It was foreshadowing for your future career. You were like, let's take this to the labs. Yeah, you know, it's working out. Yeah, I used to, my dad used to do this thing. My dad was not abusive. I'm going to say that before, like, I have to say it into the camera before people are like, wow. He used to do this thing where I'd be like, oh, dad, like, I hit my knuckle on the door frame and it hurts so bad. And he would only do it when I was, like, whining about something that was, like, actually probably, like, fine, you know? And then he'd be like, well, how does your left knee feel? And I'd be like, it feels fine. And then he'd go like, and I'd be like, ow, what the hell? And then I'd be like focused on that. And he'd be like, well, how's your knuckle feel? And I'd be like, I don't know. Why'd you hit me in the freaking knee? He's like, well, I fixed your problem. And he thought it was so funny. I'd be like, you just made another problem for me. You didn't really fix my problem at all. Good parenting, John. But no, it actually did kind of help though. Cause it would like kind of distract and like ease the tension. But that's basically what you're doing for your headaches, you know, topically.
Yeah. Yeah, and the idea of like trying to like keep the contact period,
yeah, right, longer.
That was something that the patient was doing. Yeah. He put a diaper over
to hold it on. That's what truly like, oh my God, that was what was driving me insane. There's so many topicals that when you like remove air, they get worse. You know, like they get way more intense.
Yeah,
like Nair, for example. If you put like a bandage over Nair, like you're gonna get like a second, third degree burn. Like you can't isolate it on the skin. Because I accidentally did that to my face one time, which was terrible. I put like a bandage over it because I was like, it'll help. It did not. It just made me get like an aggressive burn on my face. So like, don't do that, anyone. But yeah, no, that diaper thing was making me think of that. And I was like, he's going to die.
Yeah.
And he did die, right?
He did.
He did die. Yep. And like, that was a truly horrifying story. So how do you get like all your stories? Like when you first started out, was it things that you had just directly experienced and now you just get them sourced from colleagues and like, do you get them from the news and stuff?
So what's interesting is the first one that I made was out of frustration. So the videos that I make now, when I started doing YouTube, I wasn't sure if I wanted to make medical videos.
Right.
It was a kind of a way for me to just be like, oh, you know, hey, that's a cool thing that I made on my own. It took about 2 years and then I remember being kind of frustrated. I was ready to quit YouTube. Yeah, it was kind of a long story. So I remember when I left Chicago and I came to New York City, you know, I thought, I was like, oh, I lived in downtown Chicago. I'm from the big city.
You're like, I know what New York's going to be like, basically the same thing.
And then I come to Midtown Manhattan and I'm like, no, I'm from the middle of nowhere, apparently.
This is like 12 Chicagos. Yeah. You're like, this is crazy.
And so the grievance that I had was like, academic medicine is, you know, I can treat the hell out of this patient. And then, you know, at the end of the day, like, hey, you did good for them. But there was like, kind of just like nothing else that it was like, you know, you just move on to the next patient.
Yeah. You know, you don't get like updates. You don't like stay in contact.
Right. And so when I went to a company, right, then I found out, oh, it's the same thing, right? You're working on a giant project with, you know, 5,000 people around the world. It's not really yours. Mm-hmm. You know, you could say like, hey, I worked on that, but that's about it.
Yeah.
So I started making the videos as kind of a way to be like, hey, like this is
my thing.
Just me, you know?
Yeah. You're like, and I want to reap benefits from like my work and see direct reflection of how well I'm doing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so it was, I kind of toyed around with like, how do you tell a story? And like, so I did a story of like a weight loss course that I did with a coach that I had worked with, I think 10 or 15 years prior. And then that started to not do well. And then like, it's been 2 years at that point. And I was like, you know what?
You're getting demoralized.
Yeah. I was like, I don't know if I want to do this anymore. I remember I was in Orlando at a medical conference and one of my colleagues at Johns Hopkins was giving a talk about hormones and holding on to water. And so he brought up this case of a woman who drank 3 gallons of water in 2 hours for a radio show contest.
I remember that case. Yes. I've been so afraid of that ever since. Yeah. She was trying to win a Wii for her kids, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yep. And so there was a couple things that he brought up and I was like, well, in the hospital, we see this, it's called hyponatremia. So it's just it's even though it's named around sodium, it's usually not a problem of sodium, it's a problem of water.
Yeah.
So if you have too much water, you don't have enough concentrated salt
sodium in your blood.
Yeah. And so I remember thinking, like, I was driving from like DC up to Baltimore, and just like, I was like, you know what? I could probably make a video of that case, because you see it all the time in the hospital. And it usually because of either medicines or the IVs kind of messed up somehow. Mm-hmm. So I was like, okay, well, I'll just make that video. And then I remember I posted it on like a Monday, and then I had to do work in Cleveland. And then by Friday, when I was back, one of my colleagues who worked at the FDA at the time, she like took a selfie with like a whole bunch of her colleagues, and like they were all watching my video, and they're like,
oh,
your video popped up on our feed, and like we were all watching it. This is awesome. And I was like, okay.
That's so cute. That's so nice of them.
Yeah. And so like that was how I got started doing the videos. Yeah. And a lot of the cases are like the diaper video and the herbicide that was published in literature. Mm-hmm. And so there's a really gruesome picture on the actual publication of that one.
Yeah, I believe it. I didn't see. I saw your replay with socks was a clever retelling of some of those elements.
Yes.
YouTube friendly.
And I think I put a disclaimer at the beginning, like if you want to look it up, you can.
Yeah.
But just know that there's a very gruesome set
about
of images.
To be horrific.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it was. I did look it up.
Yeah, there were two actually. There was a second case that involved.
There was another one with herbicide.
So it involved a fetus.
Ooh, so it was like they were trying to do a back alley situation.
Yeah. Well, herbicide? I don't even know back alley. The woman just didn't.
Got it. Yeah. Dang.
Yeah.
Dang, that's very unfortunate. She had no idea that it was gonna.
Wow,
that's actually really tragic.
Yeah, and so that publication, yeah. So it's I have a team of four people who help mm-hmm. me with the videos. I think three of them are in practice. There's mm-hmm. one working at a company. So yeah, it's a whole bunch of us. We work together on these videos, and we're getting more towards the patient advocacy part. So there's recent videos where the patient shows up.
Oh, at the end if they make it. That's awesome. I love that. I have a question about your team as well.
Yes.
That my brother and I were talking about this morning, actually.
Yep.
You're the white guy actor that you have in a lot of your videos.
He was
in your herbicide video. Yep. I love that guy.
He just texted me.
Did he?
I got on my phone and I got a notification from him.
Love that guy. He looks like he has so much fun in the videos. Like when he's like acting out these horrifying things, he's like doing the expressions. He looks like he loves his job.
He's a professional actor.
You can tell.
He was trained in Los Angeles, and he was there for 10 years.
That's awesome. Yep. And so does he get like a salary? Does he get like a...
Yep. Yeah, I pay him per video. And then usually like I'll actually even ask him like, hey, what do you think about this case? And, you know, just get some input from him.
That's
and like
so
we're
cute.
Working on some other videos that he's going to be in later this year.
I'm like a stan of him. Like I love it. I love how good he is in it. Like he makes like half the video for me. Your storytelling is great, but then like his acting in it, I'm like, this guy slaps. What about the other actors? Is this like a Craigslist? Do you use an agency? Like how do you get the smaller roles?
It depends on where I'm filming. So in some cities, they use a website that mm-hmm. you can find actors. In other cities, it's by word of mouth.
Oh.
And then, some other cities, it's like you have to go on Facebook and then like go in these groups and then like, hey, I'm looking for this actor. And then like there'll be like a bunch of responses.
That's cool. And then you'll be like, yeah, that guy could play a doctor. I like that guy.
Yeah.
That's one thing. You have the final say, right? Like you pick everybody.
There's a producer I work with and she helps with kind of figuring out.
She narrows.
Yeah, well, she also helps like bring me down to earth a little bit.
What do you mean? Because, you get a big head?
Sometimes like I have like the grand vision of something.
Oh, where you're like going full Quentin Tarantino with it. And you're like, I can see the shot. Let's wide pan.
Yeah.
Get in. All right. And then we zoom out, show the whole globe, spin around. That's you?
Yeah.
And I love that.
She'll keep bring me down to earth and be like, look, your primary objective is to communicate what happened to the person.
You're like, I guess. Could be cool cinematography shot.
Yeah.
That's so funny. Okay. With YouTube and stuff. When did you first like start like going crazy, like popping off on there? And were you immediately like, this is going to be me now? Or were you just like, I don't know what to do about this?
It was that first medical video about mm-hmm. the 3 gallons of water in 2 hours. Because I remember there was like a whole bunch of cases that I thought, well, okay, if we're here, we're doing this.
Yeah.
But there was a precursor to those medical videos. It was a story of like tech. Like I remember before I was about to quit YouTube, I was like, because I had posted a video and I had lost like 1,000 subscribers and I only had like 16,000 at the time.
And so it hurt really bad.
Yeah. And at the time you could watch it on Social Blade and like the number was going down.
You're like, this sucks. What did I do?
I was sitting there and I'm just like, I just want to quit. Like, I don't want to spend any more time doing this. And so I remember sitting in the room and just thinking like, this computer has made all the videos in the last 2 years, but I have footage of myself building it. Because I had built it 7 years earlier.
That's cool.
And so I was like, well, how about this? It's like a last ditch effort, last video I'm ever going to make. I'm going to do the story of me building this computer and how it did so much for me because I'm going to get rid of the computer afterwards. And
that's so poetic, actually. That's amazing.
And that video started doing well. And I was like, well, this format might have something to it. And then that format ended up being the medical videos.
Oh my God. And wait, so that was cute.
That was how it started.
It's you and your computer's love story. I love that, actually. I'm like making your computer a little person, like anthropomorphizing your laptop. I'm like, your laptop knew that you shouldn't quit.
The second one was a laptop that I had gotten, I think like 11 years earlier. And like I had kept it because like it came with me to the move to New York. And I was like, I kept this laptop and like
so
it still had like my old work files on it. And I was like, well, I'll tell the story about that one too.
The Pisces in me is really coming out right now where I'm like, oh, your computer. I love your computer. I'm such a weirdo. I'm sorry.
Well, no, it in a way, it basically saved me from quitting YouTube.
Which is great because you're absolutely killing it.
Thanks.
You're killing it on YouTube. And you make educational content, which is like, first of all, very evergreen, but also really important because a lot of people don't know where to turn to for their information. And you're a very valid source for information because you have a background and you put a lot of work into these videos. You have a team helping you. You know, you're doing a lot of awesome stuff with your platform. Not everybody else can say the same.
Thanks.
Having a very positive impact, I think. And you saw a lot of cautionary tales. Like you were talking about like the ramen noodle video, for example, about the guy who had celiac and he didn't know he had celiac.
Yes.
Can you speak to that?
Yeah, so there was a person who fell on hard times. He bought a scam business and didn't have any money after that and got really stressed and scared that he couldn't pay his loan back because he had gotten a loan to buy that business. So he made all these lifestyle cuts and the biggest one was going to just ramen noodles because that was the cheapest kind of food, lowest cost food that he could get and while saving money. And so the more he ate, he started becoming delusional and started like saying things. And his wife was thinking like,
what's going on with him?
Yeah. Like, and it was like a slow decline where eventually she just didn't know who he had become. And so she was like, I don't know what's going on. And then when they went to the checkup, they did a blood test and they found he had a vitamin deficiency. Mm-hmm. It was a B vitamin deficiency. And so this wasn't in the video. There was an original cut of the video that I thought was maybe a little too confusing.
Okay.
So he was told he had a B vitamin deficiency and he found on the shelf there was B1 and B6. And he said, well, if there's a 6 versus a 1.
It's more B.
Right. Yeah. It must be 6 times stronger. So I'm just going to take a bunch of B6.
Oh, no.
So he overdid it on the B6. What's interesting is the overdose of B6 and the deficiency of B6 look exactly the same.
That's actually so annoying.
it's the only one that's like that.
Really?
Yeah.
And so he just happened to take like the worst one for this.
Right. So he was taking it and then they were like, are you taking, you're either not taking this at all or you're taking too much.
Yeah.
And so then he ended up going back and then he found B12 and he's like, oh, this must be 2 times stronger than 6.
My goodness.
So he started taking a bunch of B12. And then when he came back, like he was already just delusional, just everything like anemic. So he was super tired and everything. And at the time, nobody knew what was going on with him. Mm-hmm. It was like, this could be anything. And so he mentioned that he was taking all this B12 and his wife even said like, it's kind of weird
messing
that
with him.
Yeah. That he's saving money on these noodles, but then spending it all on B12. Supplements.
Oh my, that's true. Actually, B12 is kind of low key expensive actually. Yeah. Especially if you get like Whole Foods B12, that's like unnecessarily expensive.
And so when they did the blood test, they found out actually he has no, he's not absorbing any B12 at all.
Really?
It's like, wait, what? Like, if you're taking all this, like, what's going on here?
Yeah, where's it going?
And so if he wasn't absorbing anything, then they were like, well, how about this? Why don't we try a scope, right? To send a camera right. down his throat.
And this is where your video picks back up. Yes. Yeah, okay.
And then they find, like, oh, actually, his intestines are smooth.
Yeah.
Like, something's breaking everything apart on the inside, like, and what's going on here? So then they do the blood test, and they're like, oh, this is celiac disease. What's he eating?
Only gluten?
Only gluten.
Oh.
Yeah. And that makes sense. So then they found out, okay, well, there we go. It's almost never that easy to find celiac disease. Like, there's people who will live with it for like 30-something
years.
Yeah, for
so long. Yeah. I had a friend who had like severe celiac disease, and they only found out because like she almost like died because of how severe her celiac was. I was so shocked to see that like his intestinal lining had gotten smooth like that, that it broke off all of like those, that fibrous tissue.
Yep.
Is that what normally happens with celiac, or is that just because he was so far gone?
It manifests in different ways, but yeah, there's like different degrees of how much the immune system has destroyed that inner lining of the intestines.
Okay.
Yeah.
That makes sense. With like eating stuff, how many like things do people like commonly eat without realizing like how terrible it is for you?
It depends. So I would say this kind of goes back to how we started the conversation. Mm-hmm. Is there's a lot of times that you'll hear on podcasts, they'll say like, oh, sugar is a drug.
Yeah.
Sugar is absolutely
like
a drug. They're
like, you get addicted to it.
Yeah. Right. And to me, that doesn't pass muster. The reason being...
Mustard?
No, muster. Mustard.
Oh, mustard.
Yeah.
I love mustard.
Like if we test the idea, it doesn't pass as a drug. And the reason why is that your body turns what you eat into sugar.
Oh, yeah. Oh, that's a kind of a good point.
And so drugs are defined as something that your body doesn't make on its own.
So
right?
then it craves at least it, in one or at way. Least it doesn't make anywhere near as much. Like it releases like a bunch of serotonin or whatever.
Right. And so, yeah, I think sugar, like just straight sugar and how, you know, like when people lose weight on a diet, mm-hmm. they'll be very strict, but then they'll start to slowly loosen up mm-hmm. over time. And then sometimes they'll become so relaxed that, you know, they're eating like how they used to.
Mm-hmm.
And so that it does creep up on you. And like everyone goes through these periods of cycles when it comes to how strict and mm-hmm. how not strict. So I would say sugar is in a lot of things
mm-hmm.
and people might eat much more of it than they realize. And that can then become an issue. Now, the greater question would be, is that something that's in our food, right? Is that getting built in and mm-hmm. causing the problems that we have, the health problems? But yeah, over time, too much sugar can be a problem. But staying away from it, you can try to stay away from it, but your body does inevitably make sugar from what you eat, whether it's proteins or fats.
The granola moms are going to hate hearing that. They're going to be like, we're a sugar-free household. And you're like, guess what? Impossible.
Yeah. So the body does eventually make it, but you know, you can limit the insulin spikes, mm-hmm. Going back to that.
Yeah.
And so just eating pure sugar can spike the insulin. And if you're able to, you know, have complex carbohydrates rather than, you know, just have that sugar rush all the time, those are things that help.
Okay. I have a question about like MSG, because like early 2000s,
oh, yeah.
Big MSG scare. People were freaking out. I feel like everybody's moms when I was in like elementary school, middle school were like anti MSG.
Yeah.
In the last couple of years, I've seen a lot of people being like, normalize MSG. It's fine.
Yep.
Is it fine?
What's interesting is there was a paper that was written. I think it was sent to the New England Journal of Medicine.
Mm-hmm.
And it was kind of a hoax. So they wrote about this Chinese restaurant syndrome.
Uh-huh. Yes, yeah, that's what everyone would refer to it as, and I was like, this feels xenophobic.
Yeah,
is it?
Well, I don't think it was intentionally trying to be like that.
Okay,
it was just kind of I wonder if the original premise of that person writing the letter to the New England Journal mm-hmm. was to see whether or not the journal would just accept whatever.
Yeah.
Right. Based on, oh, you're from whatever institution, you have this backing on your name. Like, well, you know, this might be a thing, right?
Yeah.
I wonder if that was what the test was. But the MSG part of it was interesting because it's like, well, yeah, if you're taking a huge sodium load, like mm-hmm. you'll feel bloated, you know, you'll have a lot of water because that's what sodium does. The glutamate part of it is, it's also a neurotransmitter. So it's a chemical mm-hmm. in your brain. So when you eat food with MSG, it tastes better, if you will.
Yeah, you get more umami.
Yeah. And your brain perceives it as tasting better. Whether or not it has those health effects could be maybe perpetuated by too much sodium.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, does the glutamate part do something, you know, negative to your brain? Probably not, at least in moderate amounts. So that part, yeah, there's these periodic health scares that come up, and they'll come up in waves, and, you know, people will be like really, you know, cautious of one thing. And like, I think on TikTok recently, I saw something about Red 40.
Oh my gosh, right? Yes. Everybody's losing it. So Red 40, is it fine? Everyone's freaking out about it.
In regular amounts, mm-hmm. like normal amount, not like, you know, taking the, like those water flavoring, like liquid mm-hmm. water flavor. Like if you're drinking that, like gallons of it every day, that's probably an issue.
Yeah.
Right. And probably more than Red 40 is going to get
in
you.
In moderation, like every once in a while.
Yeah.
It's fine.
I think probably in regular amounts, it might be okay. I don't know if people like it might have an allergy to it.
Oh yeah. That's probably possible.
Yeah.
I'm sure there's some people who are allergic to Red 40. I feel like I've heard of that.
Yeah. Happening. And so there was the meme of like Red 40 maxing, and like people would just joke about like, what is it? Like something about becoming infertile because of
Red 40 maxing.
Yeah.
Speaking of maxing, looks maxing.
Oh yeah.
There's some dangerous stuff with looks maxing. And one of the more severe things is bone smashing. Have you heard of this?
Yes.
You've heard of bone smashing?
Yes.
So for anyone who doesn't know, it's like you take rocks and other sharp things. Some people use a gua sha and you just hit yourself in like the jaw and like the cheeks to try and like make them grow bigger. It's the same, like, it's like a very shitty version of how some plastic surgeries work, like a rhinoplasty. Obviously your cartilage is broken and reset, but it's just people taking rocks and smashing their face slowly in the hopes that it'll eventually like reform rather than just fully breaking it and trying to reform the way like an expert would in a controlled environment.
Yeah.
What's up with all the looks maxing stuff? Like that's the worst one I've heard of. Like, do you know any others that are like dangerous?
There's a lot.
Well, there is one other one that I know of that's like bad, where you like tie weights to your
thing. Yeah.
That one's an old one though. There's like some traditional like cultures that have practiced things like that over time.
Yeah, I think in Taiwan they drag cars. Like they'll tie.
I've seen that. It's kind of impressive actually, you know. Yeah. There's no way it's good for you, but also like, wow.
There was a funny thing when I was growing up, because I grew up with Chinese parents
mm-hmm.
and it was what is it? If an ant can lift 500 times its body weight, then it's strong.
Yeah.
So therefore, if you eat ants, then you will become strong. And it was like kind of like the logic.
You are what you eat.
Yeah. And it was like, I don't know how serious a lot of it was, but it was just kind of like a...
It's like a proverb.
Yeah.
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 That's kind of cute though. There are some places like Brazil. There's this one restaurant. I don't know if you've seen Chef's Table. You should watch it. It's good.
Okay.
But there's this one guy, like I think his name is Alex Atal, and he takes Brazilian ants from like the Amazon and he puts them on some of his desserts because the ants taste exactly like lemongrass, and lemongrass isn't native to Brazil. Mm-hmm. So he uses it as like a literal like herb,
okay.
But it's an ant.
Interesting.
And so like some places like ants are where it's at. So maybe your parents were right about the ants.
Maybe
you should get into ants.
Well, we never ate ants, but it was
kind of
like that.
Well, and that's why you can't lift like 500 people. Like, you should have started early. Now what? The looks maxers? Ants.
Oh, yeah.
Maybe we should start eating ants. They pointed this episode that's supposed to be about like being healthy, and they're like, and that's where I learned to eat ants.
Yeah, their takeaways. Oh, yeah.
Oh, ants.
He said eat ants. Let's do it.
So buff. Let's eat ants. Don't eat ants. Well, actually, you can, but it won't make you that strong. But it might taste like lemongrass. But speaking of like being super strong, you talk a lot about overexerting yourself, mm-hmm. over-exercising. And before we started filming, I mentioned to you that you have a video that like scarred me for life during COVID. I was watching it about a guy in college, I believe, right? A football player.
Yes.
He had gotten dumped. He was trying to like better himself, work through the breakup. And so he started hitting the gym super hard, which I think is a really relatable like thing a lot of people do where they're like, whatever, she doesn't even matter. I'm going to get hot. I'm going to work on myself. I'm going to start reading. It's going to be cool. I'm going to do my gua sha. And like that can actually all be great. But, you know, within the realm of normalcy, he obviously took it too far. Can you give us a little summary on that story? Because that is like my deepest fear now.
Yeah.
What happened to him?
Yeah, he did this ultra intense workout of like hundreds of reps of squat in like 20 minutes nonstop.
Yeah, like 500, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And what happened was he had something called rhabdomyolysis. And what that is that the muscle starts to dissolve and then it leaks the muscle proteins in the bloodstream. Mm-hmm. And what happens is your kidneys will then catch these muscle proteins and the muscle proteins will then basically just nuke your kidneys.
Yeah.
And so he had done significant muscle damage. I don't know what prompted him to like separate his brain from that kind of pain, I guess.
I think he was just going through it that much, you know, like it might've been a situation, like a little emo about it where it's like the pain fuels me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so he had this this kidney, it was impending kidney damage. Mm-hmm. But then what happened, I remember when he came through the emergency room, was he had something called compartment syndrome.
Right.
So the muscles are like they're bundled together and they're covered in these bundles. Mm-hmm. And the thing is when the muscle starts to die, it'll actually start to swell. But because it's covered by that membrane, it swells, but there's no room to go anywhere because it's covered by that membrane. What happens is this starts to compress the blood vessels going to the leg mm-hmm. and then starts to compress the nerves. And if you don't do anything about it, the leg's going to need to be amputated. Mm-hmm. So they sent him in to do surgery to relieve that pressure. They had to do like this deep cut, you know, in his leg. And then it seemed like everything was okay, but this was a pretty traumatic health episode to him because mm-hmm. it really did shut down his kidneys. He wasn't making any urine. He had to be admitted into the hospital. Then something that happened, I remember him coming into the emergency room about a year later and the diagnosis was different.
Yeah.
The diagnosis was that he had kidney cancer and that kidney cancer had already spread all throughout his body.
Oh my gosh.
And that was only about a year afterwards. So the question was, did he do something in between that time mm-hmm. or did he already start to have the, you know, parts of that kidney cancer start developing in his body mm-hmm. before he did the 500 reps of squat in 20 minutes?
Yeah.
So what was interesting is that particular kidney cancer that he had was something called renal medullary carcinoma. Mm-hmm. And it's a kidney cancer that's associated with sickle cell. Mm-hmm. And so sickle cell, there's predominantly the common ones that we're thinking of, there's sickle cell disease and there's sickle cell trait. So in your body, you have two copies of a gene, one from your mom, one from your dad. Mm-hmm. And it also kind of helps our bodies to become more robust, right? And so there's in the two copies, like, you know, when people have dark hair, they have a dark hair gene and then that dark hair gene's dominant versus the light hair gene.
Which is recessive.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so sickle cell disease is both genes say you have the sickle gene for mm-hmm. your red blood cells. So sickle cell is the red blood cells become a sickle shape. Mm-hmm. Sickle cell disease is your blood cells will be sickle shaped all the time.
Oh, okay.
Then there's sickle cell trait. So you have the dominant regular non-mutated gene, and then you have the sickle gene. Mm-hmm. So in that case, the dominant one takes over and says, none of your cells are sickle, mm-hmm. except when your blood cells have to go through a really crazy environment, either low oxygen, or it has a lot of salt, or just some kind of environment mm-hmm. where it's so extreme that something changes.
Yeah.
So one of those places that has that environment is the kidneys.
Okay, so when he was overexerting himself,
yes.
it was putting him through this kind of extreme scenario where now he's getting these sickle-shaped cells.
Yes, and so in patients with sickle cell trait, mm-hmm. their blood cells are not sickle anywhere except in their kidneys. And then when you combine it with this extreme exercise,
now it's everywhere.
Now you're predisposing it to really happen in the kidneys. And so I remember around the time that he came in through the emergency room, the NCAA mm-hmm. had put a statement out about athletes getting really ill like, you know, when you're doing like two a days in football, like in August, and it's like hot and humid, and you know, you're pushing your athletes to the max, sometimes they might not feel well, right, while they're playing. And the recommendation was just don't push it if they're known to have sickle cell. The more you push it, the more you might be predisposing them to a risk of this particular kidney cancer. And so that particular patient, I remember him very clearly because I remember him coming back the second time. Because when I heard the 500 squat already, I was like, wow, that's really extreme. Something.
Yeah.
And then when he came back with the cancer, I was thinking, wow, this is really something remarkable.
Yeah.
Interestingly, I think maybe about 6 or 7 years later, I was in Miami for a medical conference. And I walk in at like 9 a.m. and there's somebody giving a talk about renal medullary carcinoma.
Oh my God.
And I walk in and I was like, wait a second. Like I remember this. And then I remembered, like, I remember this patient's face. And like, I wrote down the name of the person who was giving the talk because he was talking about how it develops in humans. Okay. And he's like, this is my paper. This is my research. This is going to become my life's research. I think I've elucidated a way that this develops in people because of the sickle cell. And so I wrote down the name and I remembered it. And then I asked one of my colleagues who lived in the same city in Houston. And I said, hey, Lauren, do you know this person? And then he's like, one of my best friends.
Oh my gosh.
And I was like, wait, what? And he's like, yeah, you want me to make an introduction? I was like, yeah, can you? At the time, like I had just started making the medical video. So I was like, I don't know if I know how to make a video that could do that patient justice. Right.
But your video did do him justice.
And so, yeah, that video came
out. Stuck with me like almost 5 years later.
Yeah. And it was, it took me 3 years and then I was confident enough. And I said, I'm like, Lauren, can you introduce me to Pavlos? Wow. And he's like, yeah, let's do it. So I remember I was in Houston for another conference and I had texted Pavlos, Dr. Masal, and said, can we do a video on this renal medullary carcinoma? He's like, it's my life's passion. He's like, this is what I study. This is what I publish. This is what I'm thinking about day in and day out. And I was like, okay, great. And so around that time, I had told him about this patient with extreme exercise. He said, funny you say that because I have a paper coming out
about
talking that extreme exercise predisposes one potentially to renal medullary carcinoma if they have sickle cell.
Wow, yeah. Full circle.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for telling me all of your stories and stuff. You've been so great on this episode. Is there anything that you need to plug before you go?
Take care of yourself and be well.
That's all?
Yes.
He's so selfless. He doesn't need anything. He just wants you guys to be healthy.
I want people to just take everything in moderation. Nothing super extreme. And always listen to your body. And just do as much as you can to be as healthy as you can. Don't go overboard trying to be healthy because then that can inevitably be unhealthy itself.
Do everything within reason.
Yes.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate you coming on.
Yes. Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
Well.
Thank you. Daisy, that's the name, Paul, followed by the K.O.